Hello, it's Friday, and this is the 38th edition, believe it or not, of the podcast, The Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted, where I, John Zogby, the boomer in the room, join my son, Jeremy Zogby, the millennial, in the room, and we take a look on the basis of our polling and our observation skills, what's going on, what went on this week. We always start with politics and then move on to broader topics. Good morning, Jer. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm fine. How about you?
I'm doing okay. And, you know, I'm ready to roll on politics. And, you know, stop me when I get too long-winded. Okay? How's that? Because
I'm ready to listen and I'm ready to jump in.
Okay. Wow, what a week. You know, talk about real and unscripted. That's what we do. To a great degree, the Trump presidency is real and unscripted as well. Now, you know, Jer, and some of you out there know that I write a weekly column for the Washington Examiner, and it's a report card on the of the week on the president. I've been doing it since the first day of the Obama administration, and it's a tough job, you know, to isolate one week and try to get a perspective on that, and then give the president A through F. And the Trump presidency, you know, has really been very, very difficult. You know, whether or not I disagree or agree with what he says or does, I've got to look at him and did he make an impact? Did he move the ball forward? Did his polling numbers go up and or down or whatever? And so I started to sketch out my week's report card on Tuesday. And it was at that point that I was writing about this week, hey, a win is a win, in reference to the open seat left by the unfortunate passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The president was able to round up votes in the Senate. You know, the Republicans have a 53 to 47 majority. They need 50-50 in order to vote on a new justice and then ratify that new justice. And immediately the Republicans lost two. That was going to be 51 to 49. All it took was two more. And there were a whole bunch that of Republicans, marginal Republicans, who you felt might follow the lead of Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, who were the no votes. And then by Tuesday, it became clear that it was going to squeak by and that the Republicans, for the most part, were lining up behind the president and the new appointee, the merits of the case notwithstanding. And so here I was concluding, say what you like, agree or disagree with the president. I certainly disagree most of the time, almost all the time. But a win is a win. And he outmaneuvered the Democrats. And then the job for me was to figure out a grade for him. And of course, it would be at a higher grade. And then Thursday night, there's a bombshell. And it continues on Friday. And he reiterates what he has hinted at before, that the election system using mail-in ballots is more than likely going to be corrupt. He refuses to endorse the results of the election until he knows for sure that the election wasn't corrupt, but strongly suggesting that it will be corrupt. And so he's not prepared for a smooth and orderly transition if Joe Biden gets elected. Now, Republicans all lined up against that statement. But the fact of the matter is, this is the very core of democracy, which is people vote, you have an election, and one person wins and the other person loses. And this is a violation. And so I've got to look at it. I try to not anticipate how people will vote. What I try to do is wait until the polling is done. But I've got to try to do some anticipation here. And, you know, we still have high single digits, maybe 10% at most, who are genuinely undecided. predominantly independents. And I've got to think that moderate independents are simply not going to buy that story from the president. One thing to allow for disruption, but maybe it's a whole other thing to say, hey, come on, you got elected with someone else winning the popular vote. She stepped aside. George W. Bush, first president since Woodrow Wilson to be elected and reelected, never with a majority of the popular vote. But the other guys stepped aside. You mean to tell me you would not step aside and that you would fight this and help lead the country into, let's say, more than disruption, into chaos, and question the whole basis of the system? So you've got to color me this week a tad outraged. And somehow I've got to come up with a grade for the president, but I think the latter part of the week is going to cancel out the earlier win earlier in the week. How do you see it, Jer?
Well, I wouldn't want to be in your position to grade presidents, because I would probably almost always give them D's and F's. Even going back to the Obama administration. But so that's a difficult job to be in. And of course, I imagine there's a lot of outrage because of everything so politicized. But, I while I'm listening to you, it came to my mind, Newton's law of physics, and one of his laws of physics, and I forget which one of the three, is every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So what do I mean by that? Everybody right now is focused on the fact that the president is undermining the electoral system by anticipating that there's going to be corruption, that there's going to be foul play. But if we recall, and I've said this many times over the weeks, that going back to 2016, the DNC basically did the same thing. First, they said it was, hey, you need to get rid of the electoral system because Hillary didn't win. They said, well, she won the popular vote, but she didn't win the electoral college vote. So now we need a constitutional amendment to get rid of the electoral system. And I'm sure there have been calls for that in the past, in American history. But that, by my estimation, was probably the loudest. And it was clearly politicized because, they hated who won. So from day one after, the election, and then intensifying into after the inauguration, it was one thing or another why America needs to oust the president. I am going to use the word coup. It very much has been like a coup, and the listeners can recall that I am an independent. I am no fan of President Trump. I've never been a fan of really anything he's done or said. But I being objective, and to me, that's my most important duty in being an analyst, being objective, I can see an orchestrated coup that has been going on since he's been elected, since he's entered the White House from day one. So to me, it's not a surprise that with that action that took place following the results of 2016, that you would have an equal and opposite reaction from the president saying, hey, look, from day one, they've been trying to hang me. From day one, they've been trying to get rid of me. And, it's an interesting criticism that conservatives or Republicans say that, hey, look, if people can go out in the streets and protest, no problem. Why can't they gather in the election polls and vote in person? Why does it have to be a mail-in? So it from an objective perspective, going beyond partisan politics, it does seem a little bit worrisome. It seems a lot worrisome. I'm not going to undercut it. And so let's continue with that. And before we move on to another topic, I mean, while on one hand we could say, look, it's disgusting for the president to say that, But taking into account the what happened before, is it really a surprise? Is it really ridiculous to think that the president could have reason to believe that that there is likely to be foul play?
It's not a surprise. We've been heading in this direction now for over 20 years. I've told the story many times that while Gore supporters in 2000 told us 3 weeks after the election that they would accept George Bush being declared president as a legitimate president of the United States, 67% of Bush supporters said they would never accept Al Gore as president of the United States. And that gave me a clear signal that Gore, even if the Supreme Court had weighed in his favor, was just not going to be able to govern. I think we've been heading in that direction. None of this surprises me. But I just want to take a minute or two to spell out what this means. So I'm not a constitutional law expert, but the Supreme or the Constitution of the United States only says that each state shall choose electors to vote formally for the president 1 month after election day. Doesn't say anything, you know, about political parties. The tradition since the 1790s is that each party puts up a slate of electors according to the population of that state. And then whichever party wins that state, their electors go down to the state capitol, cast their vote for president. And by and large, there's been no conflict here. It's worked. We've had our troubled elections, and no need to get into all of that. We've had them recently, in fact. But there's a clarity there in terms of who gets down to the state capitol and, for the most part, how they cast their vote. So if the president declares that he does not concede this election, he technically has the authority, according to the Constitution, to go to those swing states where the local legislatures are controlled by Republicans and to tell them to bypass the tradition, not the law, but the tradition of the party selection of their electors, and to choose a new slate of electors to go down and vote, meaning that they would choose loyal Republicans. And now, at best, you're creating a whole new tradition. At worst, you're undermining a system by and large that's worked for years and years. I'm certainly not going to deny the corruption on both sides. I'm certainly not going to deny that there are a lot of people, I think particularly younger people, who just don't trust very much about this system. But I am going to say that this is very disruptive. And if we do not and cannot perform orderly elections, then we're looking at a period of beyond disruption, a period of chaos. And that obviously is really troubling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really goes back to George Washington's farewell speech, in which he warned about partisanship and, mm-hmm. and political parties. And of course it's been tumultuous since day one. One of the founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton, was you know, shot and killed because of partisan politics. So it's nothing new. So what is it today that we're reaching this boiling point? Is it the law of entropy that all things have a shelf life and eventually order just, you know, falls into disorder? You know, that's the 30,000 foot view of it all that explains it. But, you know, going down and drilling into it and getting into the specifics, I think it's that the parties are really no longer about public servants, people, mm-hmm. politicians who serve the people, but it's really just become about the lobbyists that own them and the party operatives that will do anything to advance their party. And I mean, it's really a sad state of affairs. And look, there's no shortage of analysts out there who are talking about the problems. I'm sure our listeners are well aware of. In fact, I know that they're well aware of these problems. So I think what they want to hear is what can be done. And I'll say this, and then I'll let you take over. It's obvious that to me, the system isn't going to be saved by having this ethos or this viewpoint that if our party can get in, we'll save the day. Well, mm-hmm. We've been hearing about that for decades. We've seen it go back and forth, and yet our system is devolving. And I mean, let's get serious. It's not because of one man. It's not because of Trump winning in 2016. I really think at the core of the problem, our culture has become way too reliant on the notion that and this is how I would sum it up, the statement: our society will evolve in advance if only our party wins. Mm-hmm. And clearly that's not happening. So what has to be done in order to overcome this? How can we avoid a constitutional crisis? How can we go back to a political system that works more in favor of the people?
Boy, those are good questions. And so here we go. You know, the founding fathers were not perfect men by any stretch of the imagination, but the one thing that they agreed upon when they left the Constitutional Convention was the need to build a national community. Remember, not only were these 13 individual, independent, and separated by geography, states. I mean, imagine Boston and Savannah, and just the sheer travel length, let alone communication. But there was a common core of principles upon which they agreed, and then that did not unfold perfectly. I mean, without tracing the 1790s and 1800s, and wow, if you want to know about blood and guts and dirty and corrupt elections, you got to go back then and see how they were run. We just have the technology today to put it in your living room 24 hours a day. But we fought a civil war over what is this national community? And there are many times that we're on the brink of breaking apart, but that's accelerated today to the point where, as you point out, Jared, I'm not sure that there is a common set of principles. I think that there is a burgeoning middle in our society, a burgeoning middle that is ready to get back to the table and to not treat the other side as the other, but as a co-problem solver, you know, as a co-Democrat with a small D. And that suggests to me, and I think I find a lot of that and a whole lot less partisanship among younger people. And that's the sort of thing that gives me hope. As you asked in one of our recent polls, do we need a new constitutional convention? And we found out that most people said that we do. Maybe that's where we have to start. But fundamentally, at that constitutional convention, to modernize these rules, to modernize our institutions so that they are decision-making institutions and not just institutions that self-perpetuate and self-sustain. The core of this has to be, are we a national community or are we not a national community? Can we get back to a common set of principles that we all agree on and go from there? Or do we all go our separate ways, individual states, individual local communities. I hope we can restore that sense of a national community. But broadly speaking, that's where I'm at. How about you?
Well, I'm always fascinated by the long-term trends, mm-hmm. right? You know, that's my approach to history is not just looking at what happens in a decade, but what happens in a century, and where's the general movement, and even not just a century, but over the centuries. And if I look back to the founding of this country to today, I would say the overarching theme of what has happened in our cultural life and our political cultural life has been the movement towards centralization of power. And of course, that is at the core the main debate over this experiment called America. And I believe it was the third issue of the Intelligencer which framed the question, and I think this is the question of the ages: power to the people or power to the elite? Mm-hmm. And so when we ask that question about, you know, should we have a constitutional convention, our constitutional convention, if we go forward with that, we'll have to address that as the major theme, because that at the core is the great divide over the American experiment, going back to the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists, or the Hamiltonians versus the Jeffersonians. And I think part of the problem is we've moved so far away from that original debate. And there's a notion out there that, hey, that's 18th century jazz. You know, that doesn't jive with the 21st century world in which, you know, we're in the, you know, we're in the third industrial revolution right now, based on a digital economy entering into the fourth industrial revolution. I say that's nonsense. That debate, power to the people versus power to the elite, or the centralization of authority versus decentralization of power, is an age-old debate going back to even before the Greeks. It goes back to the beginnings of civilization. It will be here with us forever, as long as humans organize into society. So it transcends technology. There are some principles which transcend technology. Technological advancement will never get rid of, you know, certain principles, and that's it. And so if we are to go forth with this constitutional convention, we have to go back to the original debate, because otherwise it's just like, here we are in 2020. Are we going to give even greater power to the Capitol, to Washington, D.C., or are we going to start rolling it back? And that's how I see it. I'd like to hear your reaction to that, and how, with, you know, your knowledge of history, you can pepper that or build onto that.
So we have the capacity, for good or for evil, to garner our own information. That, you know, technology has empowered us to do that. And I think with that knowledge comes a responsibility. And one of the responsibilities, I think, is to end this notion that government service is permanent. Because the longer I stay in my seat or strive to move up, you know, to director of the agency or get promoted to still another agency, the more I'm going to fight for my own interests first, and then for the people second. And I think that a lot can be said for, you know, the moral equivalent of term limits. In other words, government service should not be a career. You know, sure, there's a value, you know, of having a historical perspective, of having been there, of knowing where the pencils and the erasers and other supplies are located. But by the same token, you know, as Jefferson said, you know, you need a revolution every 20 years. Well, he wasn't talking, I hope, about mobs in the streets. I think what he was talking about is turnover, you know. So we elect, on an elective level, we elect our congressperson. And sure, there's an understanding that the bond with the people is extremely important, and that they need to get reelected. But unfortunately, what happens too often with that desire for reelection is that they turn into entitled individuals. I've seen this. I've had clients like this. This is my seat. How dare anybody, try to go after my seat? But it's the same thing, I think, with within the bureaucracy. And I think, hey, look, if you serve three or four terms in Congress, rather than being in touch with the people, quote unquote, meaning you go home every Thursday evening, you march in a parade on Friday, you have coffee with a group on Saturday afternoon, you go to church and shake hands with people, that you actually come home for a few years and get a real job and then go back, you know, try to go back to Congress. But meanwhile, don't allow yourself to become entirely a creature of Washington, D.C., and entirely a creature of having to deal with people on basis of how much money they can give you so that you can win, and spend most of your time, not most, but a lot of your time on the telephone. That's just another aspect of this. And I think we've pretty much aired this out today. I think, again, we have found some commonalities. And I also want to point out that because it's Friday morning, that means neighbors on both sides of me are mowing their lawn during our podcast. I can hear it. I hope everybody else can't. But that's a tradition around here with the Zogby Report. Jer, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's always good to end with a Mark Twain quote that I think sums up these 28 minutes, and that is, politicians in diapers need to be changed often for the same reason.
That's why he's Mark Twain and we're just the rest of us. That's wonderful. Hey, thanks. And now, if you're listening and you're enjoying this, then please spread it around, okay? If you're listening and not enjoying this, then please write to Jeremy and let him know. Have a great week. Thanks, Ryan Miller, and we'll see you next week on the Zogby Report.
Take care, everyone.